You will be hearing the story of a 10-year-old, Gabriel Flight, and how important self-defense is to him. Everyone overlooks bullying, and children who are being bullied are afraid to stand up for themselves, but maybe this can change some people's minds. Welcome to A Small Boy's Dream. Made by Rosemary Flight with the help of Gabriel Flight. Let's start by talking about what an average day at school is like for Gabriel.
Well, I get into the cafeteria, and then breakfast. It's pretty much different every day. And then go outside, you know, play with my friends, go in class, and probably homework first thing. No, first thing actually put, get everything out from my book bag. And then we have to do some paper thing. Math message, just pretty much math. Actually read a book if you finish before everyone else. We want to go over the paper. Another math message. And then sometimes on Wednesday, we get art. At lunch, I do eat food. Then we go outside. Then we go back in class. And then go home. That's my favorite part.
As you can see, an average school day doesn't involve anything real horrific, but as we break down more of what happens at Gabriel's school, you will soon find out that maybe at first what a child tells you might not be all that there is to a story.
Some kid in first grade was beating me up in the bathroom, so I used jiu-jitsu to defend myself. He used his coat to try to choke me. So I did a really naked choke to choke him, and then a teacher came, and then she broke us up, and then she took us to like the office. I felt upset, cause I thought the teacher was gonna give me a pink slip that day, but she didn't. I was upset that he was trying to beat me up. After school, I told my mom about what happened, and she was proud of me for defending myself. He was a big bully.
You have heard Bear's stories, Mel, about those small details in the second that you normally wouldn't hear about. What makes you think then that every child out there is being bullied and just can't defend themselves? Why don't we go into what jiu-jitsu means to Gabe? Why he joined it, and what are some of his best lifelong memories so far? So right now it's when Gabe started getting into one of his favorite moments in life.
When I got my yellow belt, I was really happy. Coach Jerry gave me my yellow belt back. Say, I don't know what day it was, I forgot. It was like 2 years ago. Now I have a new belt.
What kind of belt do you have now?
A yellow, black, yellow belt.
Oh, that's neat.
And when he started talking about what made him get into jiu-jitsu, pay attention to the tone of his voice because it will pick up key points of how it was before jiu-jitsu.
Mom told me, I don't really remember though, at camp the kids were bullying me.
Now pay attention to what makes somebody a role model for him.
Jared, me into jiu-jitsu.
He brought you into jiu-jitsu?
It's interesting that he comes up with such a short, simple answer, but you still feel something from it. It points out that he is so grateful to have something he loves and makes him feel good about himself. This is something every child should be able to have and be grateful for, because in this society, kids are so involved in their video games and cell phones, they forget what's important. This is something like how every child should answer. They shouldn't say an actor or singer. It should be somebody who has actually made a difference in their life, not entertained them for a short period of time.
Those ones are good people. Yeah. Still, everyone deserves respect.
In these two quotes from him, it is clear that this boy has his head on straight. He knows and believes that if somebody is a good friend, they are also a good person, because you don't want to be friends with somebody if they are bad. He also has a lot of respect, which is something that not many people in society have anymore. He knows that it's not right to make judgments, no matter what a person does. Just on a side note about this boy, I think he would make an amazing friend from the things that he has been saying while we have talked. This young, brilliant boy is very wise beyond his years. He knows what he wants, what's right or wrong, and how to meet those goals. This young boy has been going through boundaries from the day he was born. He was born with hydrocephalus and fought the boundary between life and death. His life has already had many things, such as friendship and what he talked about here, self-defense. Even though he is only 10, this boy is a great role model for anyone. I would also like to take the time out to thank you for talking to me and breaking down such personal parts of his life. And now he would like to say something as a final ending to this radio session.
I love you all. Not really, though, because I don't know you all. But goodbye!
Thank you for listening and paying attention. Please stay tuned for another topic about boundaries in somebody's life.
Earl Foreman had a pretty large family growing up as a child. Life wasn't easy for the young boy, and as a grown man, he now wishes that things could have been a little easier, because his childhood led to something very traumatic.
What was your childhood like?
I grew up, I had four sisters, and I was the only boy, and had a pretty good childhood. I mean, didn't get everything I wanted in life. My dad wasn't there for me, and I kind of regretted that. I mean, that my dad wasn't there. So I ventured off and did other things to kind of replace my father not being there. Mm-hmm. One of the things I did was linked on another man to take the place of my father. He was supposed to be my godfather. And in the process, he molested me, which led me into using drugs.
What kind of drugs?
Cocaine. It started off with regular cocaine. And then from there, I went to freebasing. That's what they called it back then. And then as time went on, they came up with crack. And I started doing crack. And crack was a totally different high than freebasing. It just sent me on a mission.
Crack is a very powerful drug. It is one of the most addictive drugs out there. Earl Foreman used these drugs to take away the pain. He went through hell to get the pain relief he yearned for.
So when you came off your high, was there any type of reflection, like you sat there and you looked back and was like, oh, did I really do that? Or was it just, I got to get more?
Well, when I came off the high, sometime it would be, I need more. That's why we chased it. Mm-hmm. That's why I went after the drug so much. That's what made you steal. Because when you came off the high, you wanted more and more and more and more, and you would go after it. And to the point, your body knows when to shut down, it will shut down. and you couldn't do any more drugs. That's when reality was set in. And you become depressed. You think about the things you didn't done. If you had any remorse, if you were a real human being, and I was raised good by my mom, my sisters, and the things I did when I became sober and couldn't get any more drugs or did it to the point where I didn't want any more for that day, then reality set in. The good family I came from, the good things they taught me, and I wasn't that person to steal and lie and cheat and rob and stuff. So it would take me to the point sometimes that I actually wanted to kill myself because I'm not a bad guy, and the drug turned me into a bad person. So to get away from those feelings, you did more drugs to medicate that pain.
The drug world is a very lonely place. Earl says there are really no friends or real relationships in the drug world. All it is was a bunch of fiends using people to get to the golden stones, the crack.
What was it like when you saw your friends who shared your addiction? Well, did you have any friends that shared your addiction?
You don't have friends when you're addicted. All they were people that wanted you for your money and your drugs. Now, I'm not going to say I didn't have any friends. I had friends that didn't get high, but I didn't associate with them because I didn't want anybody really seeing me the way I was. So you started hanging with the people that were like you. They say birds of a feather flock together. That's so true. Because all I wanted to hang with was people that did drugs, because I didn't want to be around people that didn't get high, because I was dusty, I was dirty, and I didn't want them to see me like that. I was embarrassed of myself. Even though I got high, I still had a little pride about myself.
Can addicts have a real relationship? I think that was a question everyone wants to know. Because, in my opinion, everyone needs a little love.
Well, yeah, I kept a girl on my hip. I mean, I wasn't a bad-looking guy, even though I was on crack. And I still had some marbles and the gift of gab, and women liked me.
So you had swag.
I still got swag. What are you talking about? Had, huh? Yeah, but I kept a girl on my hip. Most of the girls I had would go out, sell herself to bring me drugs. I mean, but when you're in that kind of life, that's the type of things that go with it. I mean, even though we generally had feelings for one another, at least we thought we did, the drug overpowered all that. So when I needed my drug, the girl would go out and do what she needed to do, bring me my drug.
Have you ever seen like a former friend that was also a drug addict, or former girlfriend that you see that's off of drugs now?
Sure. I met one that was really, really, that I was really into. We lived together. She left her husband for me. Now, today, she's off of drugs, and I'm off of drugs, and she's a minister.
Earl is naturally a funny guy. It has always come natural to him. Was this just a cover-up so people wouldn't think of his past?
I know you're a funny guy. Like, you could be really hilarious at points in time. Was that, like, back then, like, a cover-up for how you really felt, or a cover-up for the dull moments, or, you know?
Back then?
Yeah.
You ever heard Richard Pryor? He said, you know, he was a comedian, and he said, you know, when he was in jail, he would make the people laugh to keep their mind off the booty, you know? So that's what I would do back then. I mean, I would make not to keep the mind on my booty, because ain't nothing going up in here. but I would keep people laughing. I would have them laugh to keep my mind off of using. But I also made the drug dealers laugh. I would get free drugs because people liked me being funny. I would tell jokes, make the drug dealers laugh. They'd give me free bag. Kept me safe on the streets.
Earl always had his family by his side. They were very consistent on trying to get him off of drugs. However, his older sister, Darlette, was there for him the most.
I do remember there was a time. I told y'all owed the drug dealer money right across the street from my house. You waited out in the car. I went in the house with the money you gave me and went out the back door, left you sitting out front. And I ran through the alley, and I was 10 blocks away getting high while you was out there waiting for me.
Con artist.
I was good.
It was everything.
Because Darlette was always there for Earl, people always thought she was babying him. They thought that Earl needed tough love, but he has a totally different outlook on that.
And he could always call me, and if I could help him, I helped him. You know, a lot of people call it hindering him, you know,
that kept me dead.
Helping him stay in his addiction, but
it brought me out of my addiction.
It was a way to keep him alive, and, you know, as long as I heard from him, I didn't care if he was calling me for something or if he was just calling to say hello or whatever. As long as I heard from him, I knew that he was still alive and that, you know, there was still some hope that he would come up out of this.
But I say this much, that people say that it's a hindrance. But I always, to this day, I know that if it wasn't for you being in my corner, everybody that's on drugs, I believe, needs somebody that's in that corner, that how you were for me. Because if you wasn't in my corner, I believe I'd be dead today. And that's the God's truth.
I mean, yeah. She, you're saying that she was the one that was always there for you.
Right. And I'm not saying I would be dead from somebody else killing me. But what it did was, it kept hope alive inside of me. Mm-hmm. It kept hoping that you're going to get out of this. You're going to be okay. Because if she wasn't there, then I would think everybody gave up on me and it wasn't a purpose to live. But because she was there, it kept hope alive. And from out of her doing that, it led me to Christ. And today I'm sober. And I believe in God.
Earl Foreman has definitely had some valleys in his life as well as peaks. Crack cocaine was definitely his valley. Laughter, family, and crossing the boundary of getting over his addiction of drugs was his peaks. I hope you enjoyed this story piece, and please stay tuned for another rendition of Boundaries. You can never think too high, so go
on and shine. Everyone, my name is Dakota Foster, and we will be talking to my grandfather, Samantha Foster. Sam Foster joined the Air Force after high school, stayed for 5 years, and then became a family man. Sam would think of his life as a piece of cake, but one thing that he's always had trouble with is race. What are some boundaries that you crossed that you think made you stronger as a person?
Learning to work where everybody thinks because you're black, and if you lay around and do nothing and don't forge your education, you stay in one place, and that's what they want you to do. I've worked with Jews, I've worked with Italians and all my life, so I've always had boundaries to cross there. Then the biggest boundary I had with that is when I went down south in the service and listened to the way they talked there, and I was not used to. Then that's boundary to help. I had to watch myself being in trouble.
Did you get in any fights?
Oh, I got near one fight one time. And if it wasn't for a buddy of mine, I probably would have been exed out of service because one boy from Alabama said something called me word, N-word, and I grabbed a fire stinger and swung it at him. And if it wasn't for my buddy pushing me where the fire stinger didn't hit him, but he learned, stay out of my way. That was adventures. I didn't get any fights in the service. I had a lot of challenges in the service of telling people where to get off. And you had to watch your ranks and all, and you got to watch the way you can talk to them, you know. But I had one sergeant, he was a master sergeant. His name was Foster, too. And we were in England. And he used to try to outsmart me all the time because he was a rebel from Tennessee. And he didn't think I knew anything. And when my mother died, I was a flight engineer on my commanding ship, commanding officer. I was a flight engineer on his plane. And when I was away, he took the plane and gave it to another guy that worked under me. Only thing about it, his name was Polsky, and him and I was very tight, so he got to take over. And when I came back, back from my mother's burial and all, and had to work around, and he had gave the ship to Polsky, but he had tried to get me on another crew. And one day he had me helping another guy on some other ship. I said, okay, I'll go help him because, no, I was sergeant. And he gives this kid who's only had two stripes on his other ship he done, and he thought he was going to say, well, you have to do this and do that. And what we have a list of what they call gigs on the aircraft. In other words, it's things that need to be done on the aircraft and then checked off. And we have in the aircraft, we had a floor. Each floor was like 5x8 or 5x10 floor panels. And each of them had 300 screws in it. And they had to come up to check things. And he got all of these younger guys around with not my rank and all like that. And I looked at the tech sheet and I checked off. I said, I'm going up and do the rotor heads. And this little guy says, no, you don't want you on the floor. I said, you get the rest of the guys on the floor. I'm doing the rotor heads. So I went up and done the rotor head. So he went back and told Sergeant Foster that he wanted me to work on the floor. And Sergeant Foster asked me, how come you're not obeying orders? I says, who gives me orders? And he says, well, he told you to work on the floor, and you said you wasn't. I says, well, let me tell you something, Sergeant. I said, the stripes you wear on your sleeves, you want me to respect them? He said, yeah. I said, well, the stripes on my sleeves, he has to respect too. So don't hand me this crap that I overruled him when I don't have to listen to him. So you take that crap someplace else. And Foster turned red as hell because he knew he had no grounds to stand on. So when they found out him and I didn't get along, my commanding officer found out about it too. So we had another feller, Sergeant Summers, in France. So what Captain Hook done is take Sergeant Summers and Sergeant Foster's and switched their place. They took Sergeant Foster, sent him to France, and brought Sergeant Summers that I was used to working with back there. Then everything run smooth. But the only time I had racism really, and not too much in Philadelphia before I went to service, but when I was in the service, and I went up to Geneva, New York, where our base was, when I first went to basic training. And from basic training, I went down to San Marcos, Texas. And that's when I really found out what racism was. Because after getting off the aircraft, and all, I walked into this here cafeteria. And I walked in through the front door, and one of the matron d's walks up and says, can I help you? I said, yes, I want to get a sandwich or something. Oh, here, I'll have to show you where you have to go get it. And I said, what do you mean, show me? He says, oh, well, here, I'll show you where it is. So he took me to the back of the kitchen, and where they didn't want whites, or didn't want you sitting in with them and all. So that was my first taste of real racism was. And I said to myself, you got to watch yourself because you can get either trouble or you going to kill somebody. So I just went on and got the cheese sandwich and waited till my bus came along where I could move. And one other time went after my came home on leave from Tennessee, after we finished school and I went to Tennessee, I was back at the base, and when I was back there at the base, and no, I went Mount. I'm sorry, Tennessee. We ran around with the white boys and all like that, and we went out to a movie. One time we went to a drive-in, so I was sitting in the back of the seat. Was nothing said, but one time we went back, and I was sitting in the front seat, and they said, "No, you can't do that." So we went and drove around and brought me back in the back seat. So we went in. And then while we were out eating one time, before we were getting ready to ship overseas in Tennessee, and we took our shoes to have repaired before going overseas, and I had heels put on my shoes, and I was sitting there with the other guys and all together, and they paid like $2 to $3 for putting heels on. And when I went up to pay mine, he says, that's $5. And I looked at him and I said, $5 is, you pay charge him $2 a piece, and he went, oh, I said, okay, fine, thank you. And I gave him $5. I said, thanks for renting me the seat. And I went out the door.
What advice do you have for dealing with racism?
Be proud of it. And you learn to be proud. Just keep your head up and don't take a lot of crap, because they can't prove it. And they're no better than you are, and a lot of times not as good as you are. So I ain't downing anybody, but when they get to think they're so much, tell them bye, keep going your way, because you're not going to stand in my way. That's the other thing about it. So don't let it get you down. You're going to have some down spots, and all of them they try to get to you. But as they say in the beautiful way, you kiss my you know what, and keep moving. That's all. But don't let it stand in your way. Keep doing what you need to do. The education is going to make it. And once you get that down and continue to get down, they can't stop you. They found that out a long time ago.
Thank you.
We hope you enjoyed.
Please comment with any suggestions or questions. Yay!